ain't getting moved. I don't care who it is. Let's go. Give me everything you got. Play fast, play hard. Let's beat these boys tonight in their house.
It's party time. It's party time.
Dad, here we go.
Touchdown.
Welcome into the Week 14 edition of the Eagle Eye in the Sky podcast here on PhiladelphiaEagles.com. I'm your host, Fran Duffy, and I'm going to be honest, it is insane to me how fast the season has gone. We're already in the month of December. Each game starts to get bigger and bigger, and the Eagles come into this month on a very high note after last week's huge win over the Dallas Cowboys. Here to talk about that win, as always, my good friend, NFL Film Senior Producer Greg Cosell. Greg, welcome to Week 14.
Fran, December. That I can't believe.
Yeah.
Not unhappy about it, however.
No, I'm not going to lie. I mean, we, just kind of going through, I've got all kinds of checklists at my desk and on my computer and everything. And as I'm going through, I'm like, wow, four more of these games left in a regular season. Obviously, playoffs are on the horizon as well, but it's getting
there. Maybe we'll be meeting in Arizona.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So
I know I'll be there.
Yeah, you'll be there.
I'll be there, I guess, whether you're there or not.
Exactly right. If I don't see you there, I'll be down at the Senior Bowl.
Right.
I mean, I'd rather be in Arizona, but that's talk for another day. This game against Dallas, it went about the way that you and I thought it would go. I mean, I think both, I don't want to speak for you 100%,
right,
but I think both of us kind of thought that this would be a comfortable Eagles win. It was a great defensive performance, keeping that Cowboys offensive tack under wraps. But let's talk about our offense first. What did you see when you watched the tape Friday morning?
Very efficient. I thought this was a game, and they were not playing against a great defense. And
yep,
I think because Dallas wasn't tied for first with the Eagles and their season has been good up to this point, I think there was a sense that they had a good defense. They're not that talented on defense, and they're not that multiple. I didn't look at this game as a game in which the Eagles offense would struggle, to be honest with you.
No.
I thought that they would move the ball, both running it and throwing it. I thought that a number of players on the Cowboys who had not played quite as well as public perception were exposed a little bit in this game. I thought Rolando McClain was exposed quite a bit in this game. I almost felt like I was watching Rolando McClain in Oakland in this game. They can't rush the quarterback. They don't have a true pass rusher.
Right.
So I was not surprised at all that the Eagles offense had maybe its most crisp, efficient look of the season.
Yeah, I thought more so than any game this year, Sanchez was very much in control of the offense.
Yep.
He played within the scheme, was very efficient, took what the defense gave to him. It was good to see.
Great point. I think a great example of that was that outside void throw to Macklin for 50-plus yards.
Against Tampa 2,
which is absolutely the right throw, because I forget which corner it was. It might have been Carr on that play, who sort of jumped inside to try to take Sproles, who came into the flat on that play. And Sanchez saw it immediately, made a very, I wouldn't necessarily call the throw a tough throw, but it was the right throw. And you have to make those throws.
Yeah, no question about it. And, Greg, the run game, last few weeks, obviously, the Eagles have had success in the run game.
Yeah.
Look, compared to other teams around the NFL, I mean, they're still one of the top five rushing teams in the league. But you've said that, you haven't really gotten the feel, that sustaining feel.
Did you this game.
Did you feel this game?
This game, I felt it a little more. And I thought that LeSean McCoy had a lot more space initially. And, we've talked about this on the post game a lot. And our good buddy Bo always tries to, put me on the spot.
Yep.
But McCoy is a space runner at his best. He's not necessarily a guy who's going to hit it up in there when it's not there. And when he gets initial space, he's as dynamic as any back in the league. And I thought he had more initial space in this game.
Yeah. And let me ask you this question, because this is asked of me all the time. And you know how it is, especially with all the people that are fantasy football fans out there, and obviously people know they work with the Eagles, and the big question they want to ask, they want to know about their favorite guys. And Zach Ertz coming into the year was a guy that people had very high hopes for in terms of having a breakout season numbers wise. Look, it hasn't been consistent this year week to week. And everyone's always asking me, what's wrong with Zach Ertz? Why don't they get them the ball more? Is this a sophomore slump? Obviously we're not taking into account the additions of Sproles and Jordan Matthews, those guys, wreaking havoc over the middle of the field.
And even Macklin's caught a lot of balls and been thrown to an awful lot.
Yeah, no question. I mean, but when it comes back to Ertz, I mean, he's still one of the most athletic tight ends,
right,
in the league. He's a potential mismatch every single week. I just think it's funny that, people still don't see that. Look, Chip Kelly, he doesn't give a about your fantasy team.
No.
He doesn't care about you know, meeting expectations and filling box scores. Like, he just wants to move the chains. He wants to get first downs, get touchdowns, and win games.
Right. And there may be a game where Zach Ertz has big numbers. That's a hard question to answer. I get asked that as well from fantasy people. You know, there's certain players that you get asked about, and then they have a big game, and
they're back.
Right, they're back. Right, you know how that works. So, again, I don't think there's anything wrong with Zach Ertz.
Right.
This offense, has it been a little more up and down this year for various reasons than last year in that stretch of 7-8 games? Yes, but you're right. Chip Kelly's offense is not built around a player, about creating an opportunity for a single player.
Right.
He doesn't.
It's not.
That's not what his offense is.
He's calling plays on the sideline. And it's funny. We were talking about this earlier today. I was talking with Bo and C-Mac. And it's, you know, well, do you think that – I think we started talking about the Jordan Matthews-Sanchez relationship and, you know, how he's having success and how numbers have gone away from other guys. And I'm like, look, guys, like, the play calls haven't changed. They're running a lot of the same
plays. Exactly.
It's just that the ball is going to different places, and that's for different reasons. Not that one's right and one's wrong.
I think the Matthews is situation is a great example.
Right.
Mark Sanchez has been in the league. I guess this is his sixth year because he missed a year.
Right.
And when he played, he is a between the numbers, between the hash thrower. That's his strength.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean he can't make a throw outside the numbers. We talked about the outside void throw. He's made a couple of good throws outside the numbers. But that's not the strength of his game, nor is that what he really likes to do on a consistent basis.
Right.
So where does he throw the ball? In the middle of the
field. Right.
So where does Jordan Matthews run his routes? In the middle of the field. So Jordan Matthews will just, because of that, catch more balls.
Yeah, I mean, how many concepts do the Eagles run where – you know, you see either Jordan Matthews coming on the drive route, the drag route across the shallow cross, or, you know, running the deep crosser with a post route. And listen, when Nick Foles was in there, a lot of those balls were going on the deep post to Macklin, and we haven't seen as many of those deep posts to Macklin. We're seeing a lot of the shallow cross.
Sanchez is not a great deep ball thrower.
Right. So, I mean, it's not necessarily a thing of, oh, well, what's wrong with Ertz? And people bring up the
they
snap
even started
counts
with Macklin for
like
a few games
Exactly.
First of all, if you're going to throw the football, and in this league you have to throw the football somewhere along the line, you have to play to the strengths and limitations of your quarterback. And Chip Kelly is incredibly smart. Sanchez has certain things he does better than Foles. There were other things Foles does better than Sanchez. And Sanchez is not a drive thrower. He makes certain throws well when he has time and he's comfortable, but other throws he can't make. So you emphasize the throws he can make.
Yeah, there's no question about it. It's just funny how that constantly comes up. On the defensive side, Greg, it's funny. You know, we talked on Friday morning after we both watched the tape, and it's funny how we'll both watch it, and my first instinct after watching was, not that, you know, either of us were right or wrong, but my first instinct was, man, that the defensive line was just so great and was so, you know, and did such a great job against the run. And your first thing that you said to me was, the coverage was so great on the back end, and really how they worked in tandem to kind of shut down that Dallas offense.
Well, and it's funny you say that, because I made it a point to really watch the run defense, because when I watched the game, I didn't think it was as dominant as the score would indicate, and obviously Murray ended up with 20 for 73. So what I did is I went through it, and I looked at all the first down runs.
Right.
And Murray had 12 first down rushes for 65 yards.
Right.
Which you would take every single week if you're an offense. Now, his other 8 rushes only gained 8 yards because he had a 6-yard loss. I think he had a 3-yard loss.
Yep.
But I was watching, and I'm noticing every run is getting 3 yards, 4 yards, 6 yards. And these are first down runs I'm talking about. The thing about the run game when you're a running team is it's a thing of attrition. It's a 4-quarter deal. In this game, because of the Eagles' offense, the Cowboys couldn't get to 4 quarters.
Right.
So, therefore, Murray stopped at 20 rushes. We don't know what would have happened if the game was close. I thought a couple of things. Number one, I thought the Eagles did a great job in the secondary, and I thought Romo had a bad game, which takes nothing away from what the Eagles did. But Romo was inaccurate on some throws. I thought he missed some things where he didn't see it clearly. He had an opportunity and didn't turn it loose. I thought this game, from a Dallas perspective on offense, was on Romo. He did not play well.
Yeah, and there were a lot of cases where, you know, after going back, you know, obviously we both – I know when I go and watch the game, I'll typically watch it 2, 3, 4 times, and especially with the long week this week, I've gone back and watched it a couple times. There were a lot of times when Romo would drop back the Eagles did such a good job of taking his first read away, his second read away, with double coverage on Witten, double coverage on Dez Bryant. There's the one play in particular I remember where he missed Witten on the comeback. There was like a miscommunication.
The third down.
Yeah, but it was a third down play.
They doubled. He wanted to go to Dez Bryant.
Exactly.
And I can't remember
who. It was Nate Allen.
Nate Allen was basically almost playing a linebacker position, and he dropped out.
Yep.
And they did that a couple of times with certain double teams. Yep. Yeah, that's.
And how many times have we seen Dez Bryant catching those shallow crossing routes? We saw one against Jacksonville where he took it to the house
and he was
in touch. And they did such a good job of taking those reads away out of the progression.
Yep. And I think that's what coaching is you understand what the other team's tendencies are, particularly on third down, and you play to those tendencies.
One guy in particular I know you think could be a perennial Pro Bowl player. He probably won't be this year because of the injury. But I thought Thursday this guy was just lights out. And that's Michael Kendricks.
Yeah, he's every time I watch the tape, he just seems to play at a faster speed. I think he may not be, because he missed so many games this year, the Eagles' best defensive player when you look at a whole season. But I think as far as the most skilled, the most dynamic, the most electric, I think Michael Kendricks is the Eagles' best defensive player.
I was thinking about it as I was watching the game Friday, and I'm thinking to myself, how many linebackers have I watched this year that I would say, yeah, he's definitely better than Michael Kendricks? And I
not many.
There's not many. There aren't.
And obviously Bill Davis, he's just setting a foundation now, so he's going to be here doing this again next year. I think as he continues and finds out what Kendricks can do, and I think he can pretty much do anything, I think you're going to see him blitz more. This year they've been lining him up as an edge rusher more than they did in previous years. I think he'll be really – he did that at Cal. I'm sure you remember watching
absolutely.
Him coming out. He was really good at it at Cal.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Greg, let's close the door on Dallas. Let's look ahead to Seattle. This is a really dangerous team, obviously defensively with the Legion of Boom. Over the last few years, they've really been known as a big 4-3 under screen that doesn't blitz a lot. They sit back and play cover three. But that's not necessarily the case at this point. You know, they've played a lot of man coverage, a lot more blitz looks, something you and I have talked about. What do you think of this unit overall as they stand right now?
Well, it's interesting because they have played a little more man. They've blitzed a little more. And what you don't know is whether it's a function of who they've played in recent weeks.
Right.
They played Drew Stanton. They played Colin Kaepernick, who's not a great progression reader. So I'm very anxious to see what they will do in this game. Now, one thing, in my view, that you will absolutely see, they did this in the Super Bowl. Last year they did it almost all the time, and they did it in the Super Bowl to great success, is you will see a lurk defender. You will see Cam Chancellor in a lurk position, because what did we just spend time talking about? Where does Mark Sanchez like to throw the ball?
Yep, that's a good point.
You will see a lurk defender,
yep.
And it will be Cam Chancellor.
That's a good point.
They will try to, being on the road, they will try to set the tempo early. If a ball's thrown over the middle, you will see Cam Chancellor lay someone out. And that's the way I think they're going to try to start this game. Now, Chip's going to know that too. I think the big, big key in this game for the Eagles, and this is not a profound statement, but I think it's so critical, is they must run the ball stay on schedule.
No question.
LeSean doesn't have to break off 50-yarders, but if they start getting caught in a lot of second and nines against this defense is fast, it's fluid, it's disciplined. Discipline is a key word here.
Yeah.
When they play their zone concepts, I know last year they did as good a job as any defense I can recall in recent memory of sort of passing on routes, carrying routes, then passing them on to the next guy in the zone. And they got Peyton Manning a number of times with that in the Super Bowl, and that's hard to do.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure how much man they'll play in this game. They may choose to play man, because the other thought there is, as we discussed before the podcast, is the Eagles are really a sustaining pass game, not a big play pass game, and they may feel, let's play man and let's take away those six-yard throws. So it's not second and four.
Right.
Let's make Sanchez drop back and not have a window to throw. Make him have to, if he throws it, have to make a stick throw with great ball placement, or look at it and see it's not there, and then the longer Sanchez stays in the pocket, the less effective he is.
It really is going to be a really intriguing matchup from a pass game perspective because of all the different things that Seattle can present. Let me ask you this question. If they go man coverage, how do you feel about the possibilities of, a Cam Chancellor, Bobby Wagner, KJ Wright in man coverage against, say, Zach Ertz, Darren Sproles, these guys out of the backfield?
Well, Sproles, to me, is the wild card in this game.
Yeah.
I think they feel pretty comfortable. I would think Seattle would feel pretty comfortable because I've seen it on film. Chancellor's matched up to tight ends. K.J. Wright matches up. He's a very good player,
Wright's
by the way.
Really good, yeah. He's explosive.
Really good player.
Yeah.
I think the big issue here is Darren Sproles. And if they play man, it would likely be Bobby Wagner. And I don't care who it is. I think Darren Sproles can beat any linebacker. And Wagner's a really good player.
Right.
But I think with Sproles, it doesn't matter.
Yep.
He's better than any linebacker who's going to cover him. So that, to me, Sproles becomes a big, big factor to me. And he may play more snaps. I can't answer that. But I think you're going to see them mix and match, but I think you're going to see Seattle play man because I don't think they're going to want to give up the easy throws, particularly on early downs.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see. And then you talked about running the ball from a front perspective. Seattle, they're very diverse, you know, whether it's three-man lines, four-man
right.
lines, over fronts, under fronts, bare fronts, all the different pressure looks, all the movable chess pieces. You know, you got guys like Bruce Irvin and Cliff Averill and Michael Bennett, O'Brien Schofield. They just come at you in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, and Averill is a really good edge pass rusher.
Yep.
Normally lines up on Lane Johnson's side. Lane Johnson's going to be in for it. He's going to have his hands full.
Yeah.
I'm not saying he won't do a good job, but that's a tough go. That's a tough go to block Cliff Averill off the edge.
And Bruce Irvin, he's a different kind
yeah.
of guy.
They
use him a lot of different ways.
Yep.
It's interesting to see what the kind of player he was, you know, at West Virginia and what he's kind of morphed into now. And he's a do everything guy.
They
for
have
that
a
defense.
Lot of athletes on
they
defense.
Do.
Now.
No question.
I mean, they're fast.
Yeah, there's no question about it. On the back end, you've got Sherman, you've got Chancellor and Earl Thomas, Byron Maxwell starting on the other side. It's funny how all these guys kind of get pigeonholed. You know, Cam Chancellor is the box guy, and Earl Thomas is the center fielder, and, you know, Richard Sherman is this press cover three corner. I think none of them have really gotten the credit where they deserve as, you know, Earl Thomas as a player near the line of scrimmage. I think he's a great tackler.
I'm not sure there's a better safety in the NFL at playing downhill and tackling in the run game than Earl Thomas.
Yeah, he made that tackle was against Gore this past week where he flew down the alley.
And he's on balance. Yeah. Rarely does he miss tackles when he does that.
Yeah, no question. He's a fun player to watch. I know he's a kind of a sore subject with Eagles fans, but, you know, just really a dynamic player. And I remember another play too where I think it was week 3 against Washington where Washington brought DeSean Jackson in motion as like an orbit motion, and they tried to throw a wheel route to him or swing pass to him, and Earl Thomas picked him up out of the backfield, followed Jackson to the perimeter and broke up the pass. It was unbelievable.
Well, do you remember when he came out of Texas, there were some people who thought he could transition as a corner?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, it's very true. All right, well, on offense, it's funny. You know, back when the Seahawks had Percy Harvin, I remember we both sat right at this desk, and we talked about how it could potentially change that pass game when they traded Harvin. You know, when Harvin was there, it was very misdirection-based offense, lots of jet sweeps and reverses and misdirection, double screens. That was kind of their identity as a pass game was the misdirection element. And we kind of pondered, okay, well, how is this going to change their offensive philosophy? I think from a pass game standpoint, you know, they're still kind of trying to find their identity. I don't know that they have really found that identity yet. And to be honest, it's blatantly clear when you watch them that it's just it hasn't clicked for them yet.
They don't do much.
Yeah.
It's a very basic, it's a very simplistic pass game. They don't the receivers don't run a lot of different kinds of routes. They don't ask Wilson to do very much throwing the football in the pass game. The bigger issue is the run game and Wilson's legs improvisationally. Those are the two things you have to stop with Seattle. And the run game is diverse. We know they put Wilson in the gun. They have all kinds of option elements, read option elements with Wilson in the gun. And you have to decide how you want to play that. You know, if you want to prevent Wilson from running in the shotgun with the read option, you can prevent him from running.
But then you have to stop Marshawn.
Then you got to stop Marshawn Lynch.
Yeah,
you can make him hand it off.
Right.
We'll see how the Eagles choose to do that. You know, a lot of teams do, you know, feather it where they sort of have that unblocked defender try to play both. And that's hard to do.
That's hard to do. I think it was Arizona did try to do it in some cases, and they got burned a couple times.
But I think the bigger issue, and there's a lot of yards that go with this, is Russell Wilson's outside of structure plays. Now, they've won 5 of their last 6 to get back into it and be talked about again as a possible Super Bowl team. And in those 6 games, Wilson has averaged almost 80 yards per game and 10 yards per play, which is remarkable,
yeah,
on plays outside of structure, okay? And on average, there's 8 of those plays per game, which is a lot of plays like that that are outside of structure. And they can happen in numerous ways. Sometimes the defense can win with a great blitz or a great rush, and he escapes it, and he either runs or he moves around and makes a throw because the coverage breaks down. Or sometimes he can make these plays because you as a defense make a mistake. For instance, you try to rush him and you run past him. And then you create a lane for him and he sees it and he runs. So you have to make sure you play with tremendous discipline. And what's going to be the Eagles' plan? Are they going to use a spy? We've seen them use Connor Barwin as a spy. Is he athletic enough to stay with Russell Wilson? Would they use Michael Kendricks as a spy? Would they use Malcolm Jenkins as a spy?
Yeah.
There's all kinds of options, potentially, if they want to go that route. Or do they rush him and just try to keep him contained? Because the reality is, and this is one reason why their pass game does have some limitations, is Wilson is 5'10 and 3/4. The closer people get to him, the tougher it is for him to see. And then he looks to escape.
Right.
Because he has no other choice. He's not going to be able to make a throw. And I don't think he'll be 6'3 by Sunday.
No. Let me ask you this. This is something, and I didn't get a chance to really crunch the numbers on this, so I don't have the stats to back me up. But let me know. Let me see if you saw the same thing. It seems like this team plays a lot more scat protection, a lot more five-man protection, a lot of empty sets.
Yep.
Than a typical team.
I think they lead the NFL in empty sets.
Okay, there we go. All right,
pretty
so there
sure
we go.
They do.
Okay, well, and if they don't, they're up there. So this is a team that plays a lot of empty sets. And typically what some teams, Bill Davis has shown the propensity to do this, other defense coordinators, same thing, against those empty set looks.
Blitz.
They're blitz. It's almost to me, because when you look at this team and it's like, if they do have an identity in the pass game, it's for Russell Wilson to make those plays outside of structure. And it's almost as if like, okay, we're going to line up an empty. We're inviting this pressure. And so, because we know this is how we're going to make plays.
Right. And that's a great point, because old school philosophy is that if you go empty, we're going to hit your quarterback. He may throw the ball, but we're going to hit your quarterback, and you're going to get tired of your quarterback getting hit.
Yeah.
Well, Russell Wilson's not old school.
Yeah.
And that you made a great point about inviting the blitz. You go empty, if Bill Davis decides to bring pressure and Wilson avoids, then you're back in the same situation.
Right.
He's going to be in an improvisational mode, a random mode, and he's very good at that. I think he's the best in the league at it.
Yeah, and the more and more I watched him, it became more apparent. You saw play after play, and either he was making a play outside of structure, or he was just doing a really good job of getting the ball out quickly, getting it to where it needed to
right.
be against the extra defender. It was really just a very interesting trend that I wish I had the time to kind of crunch the numbers on. It'll be interesting to see how the Eagles.
I believe firmly that, and I don't know this for a fact, it's just my sense of watching them play. I would bet that the coaching staff encourages him to move around and make plays improvisationally. Not that you roll the ball out, in practice and just say, Russell, run around. But my guess is that they feel that he is so dangerous and poses such a problem for defenses when he does break structure that it benefits them much more so than the negative of playing outside of structure.
Yeah, and you've seen the good and bad with that, too.
Right.
If you remember the Arizona game a couple weeks ago, he got sacked 7 times.
Yeah.
Not all of those were on his offensive line. I mean, there were plays where he kind of ran into the
and
pressure.
And they beat Carolina a few weeks ago on a late touchdown, but they had 6 points until about 2 minutes were left in the game, and their offense looked very bad.
Right. And, not to say that he's like, a Cam Newton or a Colin Kaepernick where he doesn't necessarily know. He comes off as a much more instinctive player, smart football player in the terms of knowing. Like he knows when to get down. He knows when to get rid of the ball. And for the most part, he's done that this season.
It's funny you say that because the term I use, and it might sound contradictory, but I think you'll know what I mean, and I think most people will know what I mean, is it's almost structured improvisation.
Mm.
He's not a guy who just moves and then tries to figure it out.
Like kind of Rodgers. Like Aaron Rodgers almost to a point.
Yeah, I mean, he moves. I sense he moves with a purpose.
Right.
And he's very – that to me is the biggest challenge for the Eagles defense in this game. Because if he starts making those kinds of plays, Fran, whether they're just first down plays, it's 3rd and 9 and he runs for 12, or there's a big play for 50 yards. If he starts making those kinds of plays, that's hard. It's tough for the Eagles defense.
All right, Greg. Well, the big question on everyone's mind this week, while we're on the topic of the quarterback position and playing inside of outside of structure, this kind of goes along with what we're talking about. Johnny Football got his first action of the week this or of the season this week against Buffalo. Watching the tape, I forget how many snaps. It was a handful of snaps. Led them on an 80-yard touchdown drive and in his first action. What did you see from watching? Obviously, it's a small sample
size. Yeah, it's too small to really. They ran a couple of these exact same plays they run. That's their offense. He made a couple of good throws. Obviously, ran in for a touchdown. Not enough at all to make a judgment, in my view. I think the bigger picture question, and if you're the Cleveland Browns as an organization, you traded up to get Johnny Manziel. Okay, he's not played this year. Now, maybe he's going to start this week, and who knows, by the time people listen to this, he may be the starting quarterback. But if you're their organization, and don't you feel on a certain level that you would like to see him go through a week as or a number of weeks as your starting quarterback, see how he handles all that, let him try to execute a game plan, see how he plays through the course of a game, through the ups and downs of a game? Because if you don't know any of this stuff when the season ends, then you trade it up to get this guy and you don't know. Now, he's there every day, so you know certain things.
Right.
Maybe he's been working really hard. Maybe he's not been working really hard. We don't know any of that.
Right.
But they have a sense. But ultimately, he's got to play. And the reason I think he'll start is because I think they're going to feel that way. I think they're going to feel that, yes, this has been a wonderful year. It's been great for our fans. We've renewed interest in Cleveland. But we have to know if Johnny Manziel is our guy going forward. Otherwise, what are they doing in this offseason at the quarterback position?
And especially with Hoyer being a free agent. I mean, you know, they don't want to just let this guy walk out the door either.
No, and Hoyer, I think he's reached his level. We kind of know what Brian is.
Yeah.
And he's had a very nice year, but I think we know what he is. But they have to know. When you spend a first-round draft choice on a quarterback today, it's not like the Aaron Rodgers era where, and of course, Brett Favre was there.
Right.
So that's different, but they can't go into this offseason without knowing what they have at the game's most important position. And by the way, there's no guarantee he's the guy. People are assuming, I think, that if he comes in, that, wow, this guy's going to be great and it's excitement. And the other part of that is excitement is not a quarterback attribute.
No. They don't
no.
They don't have jersey sales in the stat column on
no,
ESPN.
No, excitement's not a quarterback attribute.
No. Well, let me ask you that. I mean, it was interesting to see. Obviously, they had the same offensive coordinator rookie year. Kyle Shanahan was in Washington, and he's in Cleveland now. You saw a lot of those same plays. You saw the post cross there. You saw a lot of the boot action to the field.
Sure, that's what you're going to see.
I would assume that that's going to be a lot of what you'll see if he does get the start this Sunday.
Yeah, because that's what he is.
Yeah.
That's what his skill set lends his game to. So you will see that. So the big question again, and unfortunately we saw what happened with RG3, the big question is if you're going to play that way with a quarterback that's under 6 feet and, you know, 203-204 pounds, whatever he is, and this may not be a concern for the first couple of weeks, but it is a concern over time.
Yep.
And over time can be defined many ways. Could it be 2 years, 5 years? We don't know, but they'll play to his strength. His strength is movement.
Yeah. Can you sustain it?
Well, can you sustain
the big question. All right. Before I let you go, college football regular season winding down. You've got championship weekend this Friday. Did you catch any of the games this past weekend? Anyone stand out to you?
Well, I watched the entire Alabama-Auburn game, and that was a pretty fun game to watch.
Yeah, no doubt.
That was a lot of fun.
Highest scoring Iron Bowl in history.
I'm trying to think. What else did I see some of?
I
saw some of Florida State.
Okay, there you go.
Obviously, I saw a good amount of that
game. Jameis.
Not a very good game at all.
But then the other game, I mean, you saw Amari Cooper obviously have a huge day.
Yep.
Sammy Coates from
Auburn.
How
big
is
Cooper? He's pretty big, isn't he?
You know, I don't think he's big.
Not Julio Jones big.
No, I don't think he's Julio Jones.
But I don't think he's big. He's not 5'11", 190 either.
I don't think he's 5'11", 190. I'd have to look exactly what the measurements are. But he doesn't come off to me as a big receiver.
No, you could be right.
Yeah, it's funny. The guy that he reminded me of, you know, watching from his sophomore year, and it's interesting because if this guy had this year last year, he would have been a much higher draft pick, was Marquise Lee. Just in the way that he moves, you know, smooth kind of player.
Yeah.
And
I think he is a little more powerful, just body type.
Yes, absolutely.
Know. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, yeah, Auburn's offense, I mean, he's coming out?
It's not a definite. They've got him and Duke Williams there who are underclassmen receivers. You don't
now,
know
Duke Williams, I looked him up because I was curious. He's not as big as I think I thought he was watching him on TV.
No, I'd have to get the measurements on him, but I know Coates is in that 6'2", 6'3".
Well, Coates has movement to him.
Yes, he does.
To me, Williams did not have that kind of movement.
Right.
Again, I'm just watching on TV. But Williams, to me, was a big body who was not necessarily that fluid or fast.
Yeah.
Who knows, but that's what struck watching it on TV.
Well, how about the big games this weekend? Anybody? You've got Arizona, Oregon on Friday night. It'll be a big game for Mariota.
Arizona beat him.
Arizona has beaten them already
this year. The last 2 years.
Exactly right. They're the new Stanford.
Yeah.
So that'll be interesting to see if Mariota can kind of get
I don't know much about Missouri. Do you know much about Missouri?
They've got a kid who's gotten a lot of pub, and I've watched him a little bit, but I want to do some more work. Is this kid Shane Ray, who's an underclass. He's a junior defensive end. He's starting now with Coney Ealy and with Michael Sam off
right,
the league.
Right.
He's got a really good first step, has been productive for them as a pass rusher, and he'll be important because, look, I don't know that they're going to have anyone in that back end that can cover Amari Cooper, so they're going to need to get after Blake
Sims. Alabama's going to run the ball.
Yeah, that's the other part, too. Right, yeah, no question about it. Wisconsin, Ohio State, Kansas State, Baylor. There's some big games this weekend.
Yeah, the Wisconsin-Ohio State game, I guess, it's a shame about the Barrett kid.
Yeah, I mean, it's –
yeah.
It'll be – I guess the big thing will be – and we're recording this late Tuesday night – the college football playoff rankings have come out, and the big storyline is TCU jumping Florida State, going from 3 to 4. Florida State obviously is still undefeated. They dropped down a spot. It's almost as if the committee is putting themselves in a situation where it's like, all right, well, Ohio State's not going to jump Florida State for the fifth spot, so the top four is almost set as long as they
all
win.
Well, what happens if Ohio State were to win this weekend?
Well, that's the thing is, I would think that they would have to win really big to get consideration.
Wouldn't it be hard? Does Florida State have another game?
Yeah, they play Georgia Tech this week, and Georgia Tech just beat Georgia. I mean, it's not
right.
Going to be
well. Let's assume Florida State's undefeated.
Yep.
Wouldn't it be hard to leave an undefeated team out of the top four?
You couldn't. I don't know. I would credit. I'll give. I can't take credit for this thought because Dane Brugler actually tweeted it out. I retweeted him. He said that. He gives credit for the committee for saying, sticking to their guns and saying these are the top four teams as we see it. And they see, even though, Florida State is undefeated and deserves to be, quote unquote, deserves to be in the top three spots or two spots
right.
or top spot. They think that TCU is a better team. So they're putting them at 3 ahead of Florida State. I would give those guys credit for
right.
that.
Right. I mean, theoretically, isn't that what they're supposed to be
that's
doing?
What they, that's what
but it still would
for.
Be hard. There's not another undefeated team, right?
No, not anymore. Marshall lost to Western
Kentucky.
Okay,
so.
Yeah.
Since Florida State is a national team,
correct, right?
It'd be hard not to put them in the top four if they're undefeated.
Yeah, no question. It'll be interesting. Obviously, a whole week left of football to play, and then we'll get the final rankings next week.
A big break before all the bowl games start.
We got Army Navy next week.
That's right.
Hold us over. But all right, Greg, I think that'll do it, man. I appreciate you once again coming down and joining us here on the Eagle Eye in the Sky podcast. We'll see you in the studio here on Sunday.
All right, Fran. Look forward to it.
All right, Greg and I just hit on some college football, but earlier today I caught up with Chris Burke from SI.com to really get into it, preview some of these big matchups in this weekend's games, and even got into the coaching carousel a little bit. Let's get to my interview with Chris. Joining us now on the Eagle Eye in the Sky podcast, you can read all of his stuff in Sports Illustrated, SI.com. You can follow him on Twitter, at Chris Burke _SI, a proud Michigan man. Chris Burke, Chris, thanks for coming on, man.
Sure, thanks for having me.
All right, Chris, well, let's start off with some of these conference championship games this weekend, the first of which we'll see on Friday night, 9 Eastern time. You've got a big rematch with Oregon taking on Arizona. The Wildcats, they're like the new Stanford. They've beaten the Ducks in 2 straight games, have really frustrated that Oregon offense led by Marcus Mariota. In your estimation, how big is this game for Mariota and his potential draft stock if he were, in fact, to come out?
I think it'd be nice to see him have a good game against Arizona. Like you said, they did a number on that offense when they met in early October. But from his draft stock perspective, I think it's going to take something pretty unforeseen for him to not go in as the number one quarterback prospect. It's really Mariota and then Jameis Winston. We've seen Winston struggle big time the last few weeks, and then a pretty substantial drop-off to the second, third level of quarterback. So, as we've seen pretty frequently in the past, when there isn't a ton of options available for teams that need quarterbacks, you get the bump up of the top couple guys. And I think Mariota's, he's played well enough. He's certainly a talented enough guy to warrant a first-round pick. And I think because of the teams that need quarterbacks, you're talking about top five, probably when all said and done, and it'd be surprising to see him slide much beyond that, regardless of what happens this week.
Well, Chris, one quarterback who might not even be able to take the field for his team this championship weekend, that's Baylor's Bryce Petty. He suffered what was labeled as a mild concussion last week. Some pegged this guy as a potential first-round pick over the summer. I can't say that I ever agreed with that sentiment, but there are injuries this year, everything else surrounding Petty. Where does his draft status sit by your estimation at this point?
Yeah, I don't think he's a round one guy. I mean, I think he could be a really intriguing day two prospect, depending on where he lands. And, you know, a situation like we've heard the Saints talk about needing to draft a quarterback to try and groom him to get ready for when Drew Brees leaves. I mean, something like that where he doesn't have to step in and play right away, I think could be a really interesting setup for him, because there's definitely some talent there. I think he's a better athlete than people really give him credit for. You know, he has a decent arm. It's obviously a very QB-friendly system that he's playing in, and that's something scouts will have to try and figure out how his game translates to the NFL. And there's concerns in his game film, certainly. Like I said, I don't think you want to throw him in as a week one starter. I think he'll make a ton of mistakes if that happens. So I think he is probably a day two prospect right now. You know, the injuries don't really bother me. He didn't have a ton of injury, or really any injury history in college before this year. Kind of a couple of fluky things, you know, the back and now the concussion. I don't think that'll hurt him as long as that, you know, the back injury doesn't linger into the combine, things like that. So I think he's a day two guy right now. And again, because of the lack of quarterback prospects, you might see him get bumped up too.
All right, well, Saturday afternoon, we've got a big one with the SEC title game. Offensively for the Tide, obviously there's T.J. Yeldon. You got Blake Sims there in the backfield. But Amari Cooper has just been running roughshod over SEC defenses all season long. This guy will probably end up in New York as a Heisman finalist. What is his draft ceiling, and does Mizzou stand any chance of stopping him on Saturday?
Well, on the second part of that question, I just tweeted out a few seconds ago an article from the Columbia Missourian, the Missouri quarterbacks coach, saying their best hope is to maybe kidnap Cooper so he can't play in the game. So I'm not sure that they're planning to stop him. I mean, I think you try to stop Blake Sims, their quarterback, you know, get some pressure on him, force some turnovers, and do it that way. I don't know that one-on-one or even double-teaming Cooper, you're going to take him away. He's just that good at this point. And really, I mean, I think what we've seen of him, his game translates really well to the next level. You know, I don't know that I necessarily see him in that sort of Calvin Johnson level where you look at him as a top five guy. I mean, I think he might get consideration there because of the teams that are going to land there and their need for playmakers. But I don't know that I'd necessarily take him there. I think that's the ceiling. I mean, I think he can get into the top five. I think probably somewhere around 10 to 15 range is a better spot for him.
All right, well, you mentioned Mizzou's ability to kind of get after the quarterback, get after Blake Sims. And they've got up front a pass rusher that's been one of the hottest names in college football this year, defensive end Shane Ray with that explosive first step of his. For those out there that have not watched this kid, give us a quick scouting report on him.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the big thing, I think, which is that first step. He just gets off the ball so well, and, you know, he can really get into the backfield and disrupt offensive plays before the blockers responsible for him have time to react. And his size is, you know, he's 6'3", 245, so you automatically think when you have those edge rushers, you know, versatile, fast edge rushers coming out of Missouri, you kind of think back to guys that have been there before, and that starts, you know, first in my mind is Alden Smith. I don't know that he's necessarily as much Alden Smith as maybe Von Miller. I mean, that sort of edge guy where you plug him on the end of a 4-3, whether he's at end or at outside linebacker, and let him go in the NFL. But, yeah, it's that speed off the ball. I mean, I think he's still developing as a pass rusher, will continue to get better with his hand usage and things like that, his consistency. But he's just really quick. He has a nice spin move. He can get around tackles, you know, has the agility to avoid those cut blocks from running backs. I mean, it's a pretty impressive to watch him once he gets going. And I think You know, it's a really good class, I think, on paper for outside those edge rush types, and he's got to be towards the top of the list.
Well, we've got two nightcaps for Saturday, including two more Power 5 title games. First up, you've got the ACC, you've got Florida State and Georgia Tech. The Seminoles edged out another victory over Florida Gators this past weekend as they just continue to find ways to win. They faced a Georgia Tech team that's coming off a huge win over their in-state SEC rival in the Georgia Bulldogs. The guy I'm going to be most interested to see from that FSU defense against Paul Johnson's triple option is Jalen Ramsey. He's that do-everything defensive back for the Seminoles. He's played such a huge role in a number of their victories this year, and he'll be asked to play a big part of that run defense, obviously, Saturday night. So I ask you first, give us your take on Ramsey, and secondly, is there another guy that you would pinpoint as the player to watch for Florida State on that side of the ball?
Yeah, I mean, Ramsey's a guy, he's probably 2016 draft, so I haven't dived quite as deep into his film as some other guys, but he, just by watching Florida State, you notice him. He's in that kind of unique Florida State position that LaMarcus Joyner played, their star position, which is sort of a combo nickelback edge rusher. It's really an unusual spot for a guy with that sort of size, and Joyner was even smaller. To me, sort of a mix between what Joyner does and what we saw from Telvin Smith, who is now playing well for Jacksonville. I mean, I think he has that. He's not as big as Smith. It's more built like a linebacker, and that's where he's playing for Jacksonville. But he brings that ability to get in the backfield on blitzes and rush the passer, as well as to go back and play coverage. So he's really one certainly to keep an eye on, because I think that versatility, that athleticism, when he is in the draft process, is going to be, I think you automatically talk about him as a round one guy because of the pedigree and because of what we've seen so far. And then elsewhere, I mean, you just throw a dart, you hit a draft prospect on that Florida State roster. I think one for me that's interesting is Mario Edwards, the defensive end, and specifically in this matchup, because you know Georgia Tech's that triple option, like you mentioned. They're going to bring a bunch of different looks. They're going to try to get around the edge with their run game. And Edwards is really a big, well-built defensive end for Florida State. You know, he's pushing 300 pounds. I'm not sure exactly how NFL teams will try to use him at the next level, but for now, he's a guy that Georgia Tech's got to be able to move, or at least stalemate on the corner if they're going to break off some of those big runs. So a good test for him. His run defense is not necessarily what he's known for, or the best part of his game. So if he comes through and plays well here, I think it'll give him a boost.
All right, last game for you, Chris, and this is more big picture related. You've got Wisconsin versus Ohio State in the Big Ten title. What do the Buckeyes have to do in your mind to earn a spot in the playoff with star quarterback JT Barrett on the sideline? In your mind, should the injury matter?
I don't think it should matter. I mean, I sort of get the feeling that it will matter. And I guess it wouldn't surprise me all that much if it mattered. But if Ohio State wins this game, I mean, this isn't like, you know, you're playing some pushover opponent. I think Wisconsin's legitimately talented. They're 10-2. They have a Heisman Trophy front runner, maybe the favorite in Melvin Gordon. And they've won 7 in a row. So this is a real test for them. I mean, I think it's going to be a tough game. I don't know. Based on what we've seen from Ohio State the last couple weeks, you know, Michigan pushed them into the fourth quarter, Indiana pushed them into the fourth quarter, Minnesota. So I think it's going to be a real tough game for Ohio State. I think they obviously need to win, and I think they need to do a decent job defensively and on Gordon. I mean, if they give up 250 yards to Gordon, have to win, you know, 42-35, I'm not sure that's going to do enough in the committee's eyes to push them in, because the last thing that the committee wants this year in the first season of the playoff is to have, you know, the number 4 seed go in and just get blasted because they're playing a backup quarterback and because their defense is struggling. So I think it needs to be one of those games where Ohio State not only wins, but looks good doing so.
All right, Chris, before I let you go, let's get a beat on some of these coaching vacancies around college football right now. Obviously, the big ones in Florida and Nebraska. You would expect Michigan to be open soon as well, although at the time we were filming this, apparently they're in the meeting right now with Brady Hoke, so his future will be determined shortly. But let's just play a quick game. Give me three names for each job. Let's make these realistic guys, not the pie-in-the-sky names that all the fans and boosters are hoping for. Realistic names. Let's throw a couple guys out. Give me three names for Florida.
Well, we've already heard several names for Florida. I mean, I think Hugh Freeze was one, and it doesn't sound like that's going to happen now. But Josh McDaniel's name has surfaced. I think that's a really interesting one. You know, Jim McElwain, Colorado State, is another one. And I think sort of a wild card here that hasn't really come up at all is Tom Herman, the offensive coordinator at Ohio State, who is operating in that Urban Meyer offensive system, and he's had several seasons now as an offensive coordinator, quarterbacks coach at the major college level. So if you want to take that program sort of back to what it was under Urban Meyer, I mean, that's not a bad option. I mean, I think he's a guy, maybe another year, maybe really needs another year or two seasoning as an offensive coordinator before he becomes a head coach. But if you want to kind of swing for the fences, that wouldn't be a bad way to do it, I don't think.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I don't think enough people are talking about Herman. McElwain's a guy I really like because, you know, you got a guy who's a Saban disciple, went out to Colorado State. He's winning games. He's developing NFL talent. You saw the guys he put into the draft for over the last couple of years. He's got a couple more coming down the pipe this year. And he's recruiting well to Colorado State, which is, you know, basically unheard of. That hasn't happened there in a long time. So McElwain, I think, is one of the hot names right now.
Yeah, and it's just not that this is going to happen or anything, but another X factor in the Tom Herman discussion for any team that might, any program that might think about going down that road, if Braxton Miller comes back and wants to start somewhere, he falls into that fifth-year transfer category.
I like where your head's at.
I mean, I don't know that you would hire a coach just to get a quarterback for 1 year, but certainly something to consider.
No, that's a good point. And, you know, people are throwing out Rich Rodriguez, and you know, the one.
Yeah, that would
keep,
be a fun one. Too.
That would be a fun one. And I've heard, you know what? I've heard Mike Gundy too, and that would be an interesting thing. Obviously, he's, you know, he's at his alma mater out there at Oklahoma State, so you don't know necessarily what it would take for him to leave. But Mike Gundy's a name that I keep hearing as well. So that'll be an interesting job. All right, let's move to the next one. Nebraska. Let me hear three names there for Nebraska.
Well, this is a different. I mean, you think of Nebraska still as one of college football's most prestigious programs. I don't know that the recent results have played that out, and I don't think you can hire a guy or look to hire a guy the same way that you would at Florida. So I think you need to go maybe more of a sure thing here. You know, I think Jerry Till is kind of an obvious option. He's yep. done pretty remarkable things at Minnesota. If he feels like they've maxed out there, you know, he obviously knows how to recruit in a similar area to where he would be at Nebraska. I think sooner or later someone's going to give Michigan State defense coordinator Pat Narduzzi a chance. And this is, you know, maybe this is it. Again, he has those Big Ten roots. It's a program at Nebraska that has always sort of prided itself on defense. It's gotten away from that. Obviously, we saw Melvin Gordon just run wild over him this season. I think that was maybe what tipped the scales against Bo Pelini. So I think Narduzzi is an option. And then you really got to consider, I mean, I think Scott Frost has to be really in the mix. The offensive coordinator at Oregon obviously played at Nebraska. I mean, he now is in that Oregon system that Chip Kelly set up there. So there's a lot to like about him, kind of an up-and-coming coach. I mean, it'd be more of a speculative pick. There's not a ton of experience there, but in terms of bringing in a guy that the fans would get behind, I don't know that you'd do any better than that.
Yeah, I like the Scott Frost idea, and you brought up Narduzzi. He was a hot name for pretty much every vacancy last year, and no one's really talking about him, I guess, because Michigan State kind of fell off a little bit in terms of their record this year. But Narduzzi's an interesting one. You would think that if McElwain doesn't go to Florida that he would be in play for that job as well. So that'll be an interesting one to see which direction they try and go, especially if they want a guy with head coaching experience. That'll be interesting. Last one. This one's near and dear to your heart. And obviously, like we said, everything that we say for the next 2 minutes could be moot in 3 hours. But we're just going to go for it anyway. What are three names you think for Michigan right now?
Well, I'll skip over Jim Harbaugh because I think that's the – you mentioned the pie-in-the-sky option. To me, that sort of is a pie-in-the-sky option because of where he's at with the 49ers, how many NFL teams might be interested in him. There's a lot that has to happen for him to land in Ann Arbor. I mean, I think Greg Schiano is going to be on the table because of what he did with Rutgers. You know, Michigan kind of flirted with him last time they had a head coaching vacancy. He's got the NFL experience on his resume, even though it obviously didn't go very well. I think Brett Bielema is another one, too, that you have to consider because of what he did at Wisconsin.
Interesting.
What he sort of has in place, I guess, to do at Arkansas. And, you know, the experience in the Big Ten, knowing how to win in this conference, which is something Michigan has not been able to do very well lately. The one name that I haven't really heard a ton of, and this is more, I guess, of where I would go and maybe the first call I would make if I was running this coaching search, is to David Shaw, Stanford. If you can't get Harbaugh, I mean, Shaw stepped in and has done pretty much exactly what Harbaugh did at Stanford and fits those ideals that the Michigan Athletic Department always talks about wanting to uphold. You know, quality kids, high priority on academics. He runs that offense and defense that sort of old school Michigan always rallied around. So I don't know that he necessarily would be a candidate, but I certainly think he should be.
Chris, correct me if I'm wrong. Was it Greg Bedard that did the piece on Greg Schiano earlier this year?
It was. Yeah.
That, I mean, I read that it was a great, great piece and talked about really Schiano's wanting to get back into the coaching game and possibly at the college level. Michigan would make a lot of sense, and we'll see what happens with Brady Hoke. I think there's obviously still a slight possibility that he gets kept, I guess. But Schiano would make a ton of sense there. That would be an interesting name to keep an eye on. But Chris, you're the man. I appreciate you taking the time to join us this week on the Eagle Eye in the Sky podcast here on PhiladelphiaEagles.com. Take care. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks for having me.
All right, so that'll do it for this week. Another show in the books here on the Eagle Eye in the Sky podcast. Thanks so much to Greg Cosell and Chris Burke for joining me as we prepare for Sunday's game against the defending Super Bowl champion Seattle Seahawks. And thanks to all of you again out there listening to the show, giving such great feedback on Twitter. Please keep spreading the word, whether you're listening to the show here on the site or you download it on your phone on iTunes or Stitcher, any of those podcast apps, just keep spreading the word. Give us some feedback, and we'll keep the show coming. You guys are the best. For my producer, BT, I'm Fran Duffy. We'll talk to you next week.
Anything that moves, I don't care who it is. Let's go. Give me everything you got. Play fast, play hard. Let's beat these boys tonight in their house.
It's party time. It's party time.
Dad, here we go.
Touchdown.